Blog Talk Radio.
As you may know, we got policies here, man.
Come on.
Anytime MC set to the mic, you gotta catch record for the rap. DJ Revolution, Carmelita, Sway of King Tech. And the rap is coming down hard in the new millennium, C-Lo. You ain't been here yet.
I know something.
You forgot, you know. You ready?
Can I do a piece of poetry or something?
Yeah.
Turn my mic on.
Turn your mic on.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
In the beginning, there was none other than the original people, skin blackened from the sun. But somewhere along the line, I broke the laws of the divine, and a curse placed on the soul of mine. Hell became the color of my face, feeling out of place amongst the people of my race. Filled with hate, I moved to a colder climate, intercourse with animals and raw flesh with AIDS. Filled with disease, sub-zero degrees, the Satan's blood in my veins didn't freeze. The hatred that I have for you, it runs deeper than your skin. I hate the one who put me in this position that I'm in, until I realize the powers of evil. Anything I have to do, I will. I still kill and destroy. Went home to Africa looking for slaves to employ. Blue eyes and a smile was my only decoy. Set you up from your roots. What good is the spirit when I have this new invention that you brought you here and deceived you? I change and rearrange everything that you have ever believed true. My soul is cold as ice is. I sold you for prices. You were hung from trees for sacrifices. Well, through the blood, sweat, tears, and pain, God's spirit in y'all still remains, which is actually more than I got. But I have a mansion and a yacht. The plot is making you think that it's about what it's not. With precision, I tell you lies through television. This social religion wraps you up with materialism. How could you kill your own? Don't you see? You're learning to act just like me. But be more aware that the truth is there. I tell you all the time, but you ears don't care. But not all of you. There are a few that get into themselves and books on shelves and learn something new. And once they know, they become so powerful. But many don't have the means nor the inspiration to go to school. And I know they hate it. But you can't get a decent job unless you're properly educated. But educated about what? It seems to me that thus far, you've only learned about who we are. Isn't that funny? You'll give a school all your money for what you think you need, but it's never guaranteed. The misled mislead you. Your faith has been broken, provoking you to do whatever will feed you. Well, I thought you could cook cocaine in plain plastic sacks to sell to your fellow blacks. But why the foundation of your people cracked? You tried to resist, but I won't stop it till you don't exist. Strong, though, I give you that. But you must be stupid as hell to be that strong and still be where you at. And you still don't have a clue. I am who I am because of nerds like you.
Damn.
I, you know.
Damn.
Piece of poetry.
Wow. That was like.
I try not to rhyme, but I try to have a point, so I did do something written.
Oh, you had a point.
That might go down.
Like,
he got another one. I'm sure he does.
You letting him go with this?
No, me, check. I don't know. Niccolo Machiavelli to His Magnificence Lorenzo de' Medici. Those who wish to win the favor of a prince will generally approach him with gifts of what they value most, or what they believe will most delight him. Hence we see princes being offered horses, arms, vestments of gold and precious stones. Wishing to present myself to your magnificence with a token of my deepest respect, I have found among my possessions nothing that I value or esteem higher than my knowledge of the deeds of great men. Your magnificence will recognize that I cannot offer you a greater gift than the prospect of your understanding in the shortest period all that I have experienced and learned over so many years and with so much danger and hardship. I hope, therefore, that your magnificence will accept this humble gift in the spirit in which it is offered. Should you condescend to read and consider it carefully, you will perceive in its pages my profound desire that your magnificence will rise to the greatness that fortune and your qualities promise. And should your magnificence deign to look down from the lofty summit of your eminence to these lowly depths, you will see how I have suffered undeservedly fortune's great and continuing malignity. the kinds of principalities that exist and how they can be acquired. Men must either be flattered or eliminated. Principalities are either hereditary with a long-established bloodline or new. States that are hereditary and tied to the bloodline of their prince are easier to maintain than new ones. If such a prince is of at least average ability, he can retain his position of power so long as no extraordinary or excessive force deprive him of it. If this prince is deprived of his state, he will find he can reacquire it if any misfortune befalls the usurper. A hereditary prince has less cause to mistreat his subjects, and so is more loved by them. If unusual vices do not make him hated, it is to be expected that he will be loved by his people. It is in the new principality that the difficulties lie. Men will willingly change their ruler in the hope that they will fare better, a hope that leads them to take up arms against their old ruler. But in this they are deceived, because, as they invariably discover, their lot under a new ruler is inevitably worse. This is the result of another natural and basic inevitability, that you cannot avoid offending those whose new ruler you are, both with your armed soldiers and with innumerable other provocations that come in the wake of a conquest. You end up making enemies of all those you have offended during your conquest of the principality, and you find that you cannot keep the friendship of those who helped you to power, since you cannot satisfy them in the way they had envisioned. What's more, you cannot take strong measures against them, as you are indebted to them. Even with the most powerful army, if you want to invade a state, you need the support of the people. If the states a prince acquires are of the same country and language as his own, it's much easier to retain them, particularly if they are not used to freedom. To hold them securely, it's enough to extinguish the line of the previous prince who ruled them. As for the rest, if the new acquisition's former state of affairs is kept and there is no difference in customs, men will live quite peacefully, as we have seen in Burgundy, Brittany, Gascony, and Normandy, which for a long time now have all belonged to France. Although there is some difference in language, their customs are similar, and their people get along with one another quite easily. But difficulties arise when you acquire states in a land with differing languages, customs, and laws. To keep these states, you need good fortune and much diligence. One of the best and quickest solutions is for the new prince to go and live in his new state. This makes the possession more durable and secure. The Turks did this in Greece. Another efficient remedy is to set up colonies in one or two places that will act as the shackles of your new state. If you don't set up colonies, you will have to send a great number of troops to secure it, while a colony can be established and maintained at negligible cost. The only subjects who will be affronted are those whose fields and houses will be confiscated to be given to the new colonists. But these dispossessed subjects make up only a small part of the state and will end up poor and dispersed, and so can do no harm. The rest of your new subjects will not be affronted, and hence will be acquiescent, but will also be frightened of transgressing, worried that they too might be dispossessed. In short, men must either be flattered or eliminated. This is because a man will readily avenge a slight grievance, but not one that is truly severe. It follows that the offense done a man must be of the kind that cannot incur vengeance. It's also important when a prince has conquered a foreign state that he become the protector of the surrounding weaker powers and do all he can to weaken the stronger ones. The Romans were careful to follow these principles in the provinces they conquered, establishing colonies, supporting the less powerful without increasing their strength, undercutting the strong and not letting powerful foreigners gain standing there. The Romans did what every wise prince must do. They kept their eyes trained not only on present problems but also on future ones. Future problems must be anticipated with great care, because when one sees these problems approaching, they can still be remedied, whereas if one waits for them to arrive, it will be too late to administer medicine. The illness will have become incurable. As physicians say of consumption, in the first stages it is easy to cure, though hard to detect, but with the progress of time, if not detected or treated, consumption becomes easy to detect, but hard to cure. The Romans recognized potential difficulties in advance and always remedied them in time. They never let problems develop just so they could escape a war, for they knew that such wars can't be avoided, only postponed to the advantage of others. The Romans never liked the dictum we constantly hear from the wise men of our day, that time will take care of things. The Romans preferred to take care of things by means of their own skill and prudence, because time will sweep everything before it and can bring good things as well as bad, bad things as well as good. When an acquired state has been accustomed to living in freedom under its own laws, there are three ways of securing it. The first is to destroy it. The second is to move there oneself. The third is to let it live with its own laws, exacting a tribute and creating within it a regime of a selected few who will keep it friendly toward you. As the regime of the state has been created by the new prince, it knows it cannot exist without his goodwill and power and must do everything to maintain him. The best way to keep a city accustomed to living freely is through its citizens. Consider, for example, the Spartans and the Romans. The Spartans occupied Athens and Thebes, creating a state governed by a few, though they lost this state again. The Romans, on the other hand, destroyed Capua, Carthage, and Numantia, therefore did not lose them. They also wanted to occupy Greece in almost the same way the Spartans had occupied Athens and Thebes, making it free and with its own laws. This didn't work, and the Romans ended up having to destroy many of Greece's cities in order to keep the province. In fact, the only secure way of keeping such a city is to destroy it, and whoever becomes the ruler of a city that is used to living free without destroying it can expect to be destroyed by the city. Because when such a city rebels, it always waves the banners of liberty and its former government. Liberty is not forgotten with the passage of time or through any benefits bestowed by the new ruler. Whatever a new prince does, if the inhabitants are not dispersed or driven into quarreling factions, they will never forget the former government or order of things and will quickly revert to it at every opportunity. This is what happened in Pisa after 100 years of servitude to the Florentines. It's a different matter when cities or states are accustomed to living under a prince and his bloodline is extinguished. They are used to obeying, and they don't have their former prince. They will not be capable of uniting to elect a prince from among themselves, and they don't know how to live in freedom without a prince. Consequently, they are slower at taking up arms, and a new prince can win and secure them with greater ease. But in republics there is more vitality, more hatred, and more desire for revenge. The memory of former freedom simply will not leave the people in peace. In this case, the safest course is for the prince either to go and live there himself or to destroy them.
Politicians, it's fashionable to say, are all the same. They put themselves first and think of the people last. They are, it is said with alarming frequency, greedy, lazy, and self-interested. What we hear much less frequently is what they, our leaders, really think of you, those whom they lead. Sure, we take for granted that those who want your support tell the people that they're the finest, the fairest, the truest on the globe. But what do they really think? Niccolo Machiavelli's The Prince, a kind of know-your-facts primer on how to wield power, made his view very plain. So plain, indeed, that the great English historian Lord Macaulay claimed that it was impossible to read the book without horror and amazement. Such a display of wickedness, such cool, judicious, scientific atrocity, belongs, Macaulay wrote, to a fiend rather than to the most depraved of men. You are about to hear what appalled Macaulay so. You'll hear Machiavelli describe men as ungrateful and inconstant, simulators and dissimulators, hungry for profit and quick to evade danger. Harsh but fair, some might say, coming from a man who was writing in middle age after enjoying first great power and prestige and then wrongful imprisonment, torture and exile. Machiavelli was no sentimentalist. His recommendation to princes that they must learn how to be able not to be good won in the condemnation of a church that declared such views to be opposed to Christian doctrine. Before you join in that condemnation, listen out for insights into the popular mood, which perhaps hold true still. If you're nevertheless shocked, though, by his contempt for the people, ponder a little about how common it is for people to hold their leaders in contempt.
I'd like now to discuss what methods and measures a prince should employ with his subjects or friends. Many have written about this, and I fear I might be considered presumptuous, particularly as I intend to depart from the principles laid down by others. Many have imagined republics and principalities that have never been seen or heard of, because how one lives and how one ought to live are so far apart. He who spurns what is actually done for what ought to be done will achieve ruin rather than his own preservation. A man who strives to make a show of correct comportment in every circumstance can only come to ruin among so many who have other designs. It is necessary for a prince who wishes to maintain his position to learn how to be able not to be good. For there are cases in which people might think a certain path is valorous, but following it would be the prince's ruin. There are also cases in which a certain way might seem evil, but following it will result in the prince's safety and well-being. For instance, it is good to be thought generous, and yet if one wishes to be perceived as generous, one will have to indulge in a great deal of sumptuous display. A prince who chooses this path will consume all his resources and eventually will have to overburden the populace with taxes. This will make him hateful to his subjects, and should he become poor, despised by all. With his generosity, he will have hurt many and rewarded few. So a wise prince must not mind acquiring a reputation for miserliness. The present King of France, Louis XII, has launched many wars without imposing extra taxes on his people, which he has been able to do only because the additional expenditures have been provided for by his long parsimony. Parsimony is one of the vices that permit him to reign. Of cruelty and mercy, and whether it is better to be loved than feared. Every prince must wish to be considered merciful and not cruel, but he must avoid using mercy inappropriately. A prince must not fear being reproached for cruelty when it is a matter of keeping his subjects united and loyal. With a few exemplary executions, he will be more merciful than those who, through too much mercy, allow the kind of disorder to spread that gives rise to plunder and murder. This harms the whole community, while an execution ordered by a prince harms only a single individual. This raises the question whether it is better to be loved than feared, or the contrary. My reply is that one would like to be both. But as it is difficult to combine love and fear, if one has to choose between them, it is far safer to be feared than loved. Men are ungrateful and inconstant, simulators and dissimulators, and they are hungry for profit and quick to evade danger. While you do them good, they are devoted to you, offering you their lives, their possessions, their children, but only as long as danger is far off. The moment danger is at hand, they turn away. A prince who has based everything on their word without taking other precautions is ruined. Men have less compunction about harming someone who has made himself loved than harming someone who has made himself feared. Love is held in place by chains of obligation, which, as men are evil, will quickly be broken if self-interest is at stake, but fear is held in place by a dread of punishment, which one can always rely on. The prince must make himself feared so that he avoids hatred, even if he does not acquire love. Being feared and not hated go well together, and the prince can always achieve this if he does not touch the property or the women of his citizens and subjects. If he finds he must execute someone, he should do so only if there is adequate justification and a manifest cause. But above all, he must refrain from seizing the property of others, because a man is quicker to forget the death of his father than the loss of his patrimony. of the need for princes to keep their word. Everyone knows how commendable it is for a prince to keep his word and live by integrity rather than by cunning. And yet our own era has shown that princes who have little regard for their word have achieved great things, being expert at beguiling men's minds. In the end, these princes overcame those who relied solely on loyalty. A prince must know how to use the nature of the beast to his advantage. He must emulate both the fox and the lion, because a lion cannot defy a snare, while a fox cannot defy a pack of wolves. A prince must be a fox to spot the snares, and a lion to overwhelm the wolves. The prince who models himself only on the lion does not grasp this. But a wise ruler cannot and should not keep his word when it would be to his disadvantage to do so, and when the reasons that made him give his word have disappeared. If all men were good, this rule would not stand. But as men are wicked and not prepared to keep their word to you, you have no need to keep your word to them. Nor does a prince ever lack legitimate pretext for concealing the fact that he has broken his word. There are countless examples from our times of the many peace treaties and promises that have been rendered null and void through the fickleness of princes. The princes who have best used the nature of the fox to their advantage have been the most successful. But one must know how to be a great simulator and dissimulator. Men are so simple and so prone to being won over by the necessity of the moment that a deceiver will always find someone willing to be deceived. There is an example from recent times that I don't want to pass over. Pope Alexander VI never thought or did anything except to deceive, and he always found someone to deceive. Never has a man made more grandiose promises or sworn greater oaths and kept them less. And yet he always got away with his deceptions because he was so well acquainted with this aspect of the world. Of course, it's best to both seem and be merciful, loyal, humane, upright, and scrupulous. And yet one's spirit should be calculated in such a way that one can, if need be, turn one's back on these qualities and become the opposite. It is vital to understand that a prince, particularly a new prince, cannot afford to cultivate attributes for which men are considered good. In order to maintain the state, a prince will often be compelled to work against what is merciful, loyal, humane, upright, and scrupulous. He must have a spirit that can change depending on the winds and variations of fortune. If possible, he must try to distance himself from what is good, but he must also, when necessary, know how to prefer what is bad. A prince must be very careful to seem a paragon of mercy, loyalty, humaneness, integrity, and scrupulousness. Indeed, there is nothing more important than appearing to have this last quality. Men in general judge more with the eye than with the hand, because everyone can see, but few can feel. Everyone sees what you seem to be, but few feel what you are. And those few will not dare oppose the opinion of the many who have the majesty of the state behind them. In the actions of all men, and particularly the prince, where there is no higher justice to appeal to, one looks at the outcome. The common people will be convinced by appearances and by the end result, and the world is made up of common people, among whom the few dissenters who can see beyond appearances do not count when the majority can point to the prince's success. A certain prince of our times, whom I shall not name, Ferdinand II, preaches nothing but peace and loyalty, while he could not be more hostile to both. Yet if he lived by what he preaches, he would by now have lost both his reputation and his state many times over. Of how to avoid contempt and hatred. What will make the prince hated above all is seizing the property and women of his subjects, which he must refrain from. Men will generally live contentedly as long as their property and honour are not touched. What will make the prince contemptible is for him to be perceived as undependable, frivolous, effeminate, pusillanimous, and irresolute, against which a prince must guard himself as from the plague. He must do his utmost so that his actions will be perceived as imbued with greatness, courage, dignity, and power. And as for the private affairs of his subjects, he must be adamant that his decisions are irrevocable. he must maintain a standing so that no man would venture to cheat or deceive him. A prince who creates this opinion of himself will be greatly esteemed, and it is difficult to attack or conspire against one who is greatly esteemed, so long as he is perceived as excellent and is revered by his people. When external affairs are stable, the prince must still fear that his subjects might conspire secretly against him, but he will be quite safe from this as long as he avoids being hated or despised and keeps the populace on his side. One of the strongest remedies a prince has against conspiracy is not to be hated by the masses, because conspirators are invariably certain that they will satisfy the populace by killing the prince. But if, on the other hand, they think they will enrage the populace, they will not pluck up the courage for such an act, because the difficulties facing conspirators are infinite. Experience has taught that there have been many conspiracies, but few that have ended well. Whoever conspires can't do so alone, and he can't attract supporters other than those who he believes are malcontents. And the moment you take a malcontent into your confidence, you give him the opportunity to become quite content, pursuing his own advantage by betraying you. A prince need not worry unduly about conspiracies when the people are well disposed toward him, but if they are his enemies and hate him, he must fear everything and everybody.
In our time, in our part of the world, war is a political choice, a choice as it happens that our leaders have taken many times in recent years, in Iraq and Afghanistan, in Bosnia and Sierra Leone, and before that, the Falklands. The image of the successful war leader has an enduring appeal for modern politicians, and yes, for the public as well. In The Prince, Niccolo Machiavelli wrote that a leader must have no other thought or objective, nor dedicate himself to any other art but that of war. The leaders he was writing for had little choice. Italy then was a collection of warring city-states who were themselves pawns in the rivalry between the papacy, France, Spain, and the Holy Roman Empire. Machiavelli wrote The Prince, part as a textbook for leaders, part as a job application, drawing on his own experiences, which include having led an army. I suspect that Margaret Thatcher or Tony Blair might well agree with the sentiment in this, the third extract, that it's always better to be a true friend or a true enemy, rather than to remain neutral. The irresolute prince, he writes, will most often come to ruin. Wisdom consists of choosing the lesser evil. Machiavelli had once been the chief military advisor to the leader of the Florentine Republic. In 1508, 5 years before he wrote The Prince, he'd led 1,000 troops in an effort to recover Pisa. He succeeded where others had before failed, thanks, he believed, to the use of a loyal indigenous militia of citizens, not, as his predecessors had done, with a mercenary army. When triumph was soon followed by disaster, the Republic fell, Machiavelli was sacked, seen as a conspirator, imprisoned, tortured, and exiled. He had the time to reflect and to write about what he'd learned.
The primary foundation of all states is good laws and a good army. And there cannot be good laws where there is not a good army. And where there is a good army, there have to be good laws. The army with which a prince defends his state is either his own or a mercenary army or an auxiliary army. Auxiliary troops are those which another prince or republic sends to help you and which are paid and commanded by them. The mercenary and auxiliary armies are useless and dangerous. A prince who holds a state that is founded on the strength of mercenary armies will never be firm or secure, since such armies are divided, ambitious, without discipline, and fickle, brave in the face of friends, cowardly in the face of enemies. Mercenaries have neither fear of God nor dependability with men, and one's ruin can be held off only as long as an assault can be deferred. In peace, one is despoiled by mercenaries, in war, by one's enemies. The reason for this is that all that keeps mercenaries on the battlefield are the negligible wages you pay them, which are not sufficient to make them want to die for you. They're eager to be your soldiers as long as you are not at war. The moment there is a war, they either take flight or desert. It is easy enough for me to make my case, since the present ruin of Italy has been brought about by a reliance on mercenary armies over a period of many years. The prince should personally take on the role of general. Experience has shown that only princes and republics that have their own army make great progress, while mercenary armies do nothing but harm. Both Rome and Sparta were for many centuries armed and free. The Swiss are well armed and very free. In the case of the Venetians, if one weighs their successes, it's clear that they acted wisely and bravely as long as they used their own soldiers to fight their wars, which they did before they began to expand from Venice onto the mainland. But the moment the Venetians stepped onto terra firma, they lost their skill and resorted to mercenaries, as was common throughout Italy. At the beginning of their expansion, they had a small state but a substantial reputation, and so didn't have much to fear from their mercenary generals. But as they expanded, they received ample proof of their error. Francesco Bosoni da Carmagnola had shown his skill in battle, having defeated the Duke of Milan, but subsequently the Venetians saw his ardour for battle cool. They saw that they could not expect any further victories from him, but were not willing or able to relieve him of his duties, since they didn't want to lose what they had gained if he switched allegiance. So for their own security, they were compelled to execute him. After Carmagnola, the Venetians hired mercenaries from whom they had more reason to fear defeat than victory, as happened at the Battle of Vaila, where in one day Venice lost all that it had laboriously gained over 800 years. Italy has been ruled for so many years by mercenary armies, they have brought us into slavery and disgrace. Of a prince's duties concerning the military. A prince must have no other thought or objective, nor dedicate himself to any other art but that of war. The art of war, with its rules and discipline, is the only art suitable for a man who commands. It is such a powerful art that it will maintain the position of one who is born a prince, but will also often raise mere private citizens to that rank. Princes who give more thought to luxury than to arms often lose their principality. In fact, the quickest way to lose a principality is to neglect the art of war, and the best way of acquiring one is to be a master in this art. Francesco Sforza, from being a private citizen, became Duke of Milan because he was armed, while his sons after him, shrinking from the hardships of military life, ended up as private citizens after they'd been dukes. What's more, being unarmed makes you despised, which is one of the infamies from which a prince must shield himself. There's no comparison between an armed man and an unarmed one. It's not reasonable to think that an armed man might be compelled to obey an unarmed one, or that an unarmed man might be safe among the armed mercenaries he has hired. The unarmed prince will always be wary of these mercenaries, whereas they will harbour disdain for him. There is no way for them to work well together. So a prince who does not understand military matters will not be respected by his soldiers and cannot trust them. The prince must never shift his attention from the exercise of war, even in times of peace. He must not only keep his troops well trained and organized, but must also himself continuously go out hunting, keeping his body accustomed to hardship, while learning the lay of the land, how the mountains rise and the valleys dip, how the plains lie, and the nature of the rivers and marshes. He must do this with the greatest application, for such knowledge is useful in two ways. First, he will familiarize himself intimately with his own country and understand how to defend it. Second, with the knowledge and experience of his own terrain, he will more easily get to know any foreign terrain he might have to explore, because any hill, valley, river, plain or marsh that exists in Tuscany will resemble those of other provinces. A prince who lacks this knowledge lacks the most essential quality in a general, because this will train him how to hunt the enemy, choose a campsite, lead troops, and direct them in the field and in besieging towns. Among the things Prince Philopoemen of the Achaeans has been praised for by writers is that in times of peace he thought of nothing but ways of waging war. When he was out riding in the country with his friends, he often stopped and reasoned with them. If the enemy were up in those hills and we were here with our army, who would have the advantage? How could we attack without breaking formation? If we wanted to retreat, how would we do that? If they were to retreat, how would we pursue them? And as Prince Philopemon and his companions rode on, he would lay out all the circumstances that could befall an army. He would listen to the opinions of the others, and share his opinions with them, which he would back up with detailed explanation, his aim being that through continuous deliberations, nothing unforeseen for which he might have no remedy would ever occur in battle. A prince must read histories and study the actions of great men so he can see how they conducted themselves in war. He must examine the reasons for their victories and defeats in order to imitate the former and avoid the latter. Above all, the prince must follow the example of some great man of the past, who in turn followed the example of another great man who had been praised and honored before him, always keeping his predecessor's deeds and actions in mind. For it is said that Alexander the Great imitated Achilles, that Caesar imitated Alexander, and that Scipio imitated Cyrus. A wise prince must observe such methods, and never remain idle in times of peace, but vigorously take advantage of them so he can be ready for times of adversity, so that when fortune changes, she will find him prepared to resist her. Nothing can bring a prince more esteem than great feats and extraordinary actions. In our time we have Ferdinand of Aragon, the present King of Spain, who, through fame and glory, has become the foremost king of Christendom. If you consider his deeds, you will find that they are great, some of them even extraordinary. At the beginning of his reign, he attacked Granada, an exploit that was to establish the cornerstone of his state. He did this quite casually, without the least concern that anyone might hinder him. He kept the attention of the barons of Castile trained on his enterprise, and, with their minds on this war, they did not think of introducing any changes. Before they realized what was happening, he had overshadowed them in prestige and power. He managed to build up his army with funds from the church and the people. To launch even greater campaigns, he invariably made use of religion, resorting to a pious cruelty, robbing the Spanish Jews, the Muranos, and routing them from his kingdom. No example of an extraordinary act is more pitiful and strange. A prince is revered when he is a true friend and a true enemy. In other words, when he declares himself without reservation in favor of one man against another. This kind of resolution is always more useful than if he remains neutral. If two powerful neighbors come to blows, these neighbors will either be of the kind where you have to fear the winner or not. In either case, it will be more useful for you to take a position and wage an honest war. If you do not commit yourself, you will fall prey to whoever wins, to the delight and satisfaction of whoever loses. Neither side will have reason or cause to come to your assistance. For the winner won't want the kind of ally who didn't come to his aid in adversity, and the loser won't give you refuge since you weren't prepared to share his fate with your weapons drawn. The irresolute prince will most often follow the path of neutrality in order to avoid immediate danger, and will most often come to ruin. But when a prince boldly declares himself for one of the two sides, even if that side wins and is powerful, that side will be obliged to him and bound by contract of allegiance. Men are never so deceitful that they would subjugate someone in such a striking display of ingratitude after he had come to their aid. A state should not believe it can always make secure choices. In fact, all choices should be considered dubious, because it is in the nature of things that you can never escape one setback without running into another. Wisdom consists of knowing how to recognize the respective qualities of the setbacks and choosing the lesser evil.
What place does cruelty have in a leader's toolbox? None, many will reply, but but by no means all. In a recent poll, a quarter of all Britons said that torture could sometimes be permissible in the treatment of terror suspects. The figure was over a third in the United States, a country where the acceptability of waterboarding, pouring water onto a prisoner's face until they feel like they're drowning, is a live issue in the race to replace George Bush. Niccolo Machiavelli was in no doubt. Cruelty could be well used by princes, as well as used badly. It was another of his apparently amoral views that led him and his work, The Prince, to become so notorious. Machiavelli knew that of which he wrote, having himself been imprisoned and tortured after the Florentine Republic fell in 1512. When the Medicis returned to power in Florence, he was wrongly accused of taking part in an assassination plot against them. He was subjected to a device called the strappado. This involved binding his arms behind his back with a rope attached to a pulley and then dropping him from a height so that his shoulders were dislocated. In prison, he wrote a poem about hearing the sound of other men's torture, about the smell and the lice. And yet he was in no doubt that cruelty was necessary to keep the people in order, recalling approvingly the example of Cesare Borgia, who appointed a resolute and ruthless man to quell the people of one state, and later had the same man cut in two in the main square to appease the people. Small wonder, then, that one commentator observed at the time, everyone hated him because of the prince. The good thought him sinful, the wicked thought him more wicked than themselves, so that all hated him.
Nothing is harder to do, more dubious to succeed at, or more dangerous to manage than making oneself a ruler and introducing a new order. This is because he who introduces the new order makes enemies of all those who have done well under the old, and finds only half-hearted defenders in the men who would do well under the new. Men intrinsically do not trust new things that they have not experienced themselves. This means that when enemies of the new order find any chance to attack the prince, they will attack him in full force, while men who benefit from the new order will defend him half-heartedly, so the prince is in a precarious position. A populace is always erratic. It is easy enough to win the people over, but difficult to keep their allegiance. Therefore, matters must be arranged in such a way that when the populace no longer believes, a prince can compel them to believe by force. Moses, Cyrus, Theseus, and Romulus would not have been able to make their people observe their laws for long without the force of arms. We have seen this in our own times with Girolamo Savonarola, who came to ruin with his new order when the multitude lost belief in him. Savonarola didn't have a system for holding on to those who had believed in him, nor did he have a system for making those believe who did not. Rulers like Savonarola have great difficulty in proceeding. Their path is strewn with difficulties that they must overcome through prowess. Once they overcome these difficulties, the populace begins to venerate them, and once these rulers have eliminated those who resent their achievement, they remain powerful, secure, honored, and content. Private citizens who become princes by good fortune alone do so with little effort, but maintaining their position requires a great deal of effort. They have no difficulty in getting there because their way is easy. The difficulties arise once they arrive. States that spring up suddenly, like all things in nature that sprout and grow quickly, cannot develop the necessary roots and connections and expire with the first bad weather. The only exceptions are princes who, though they have become princes suddenly, have so much skill that they instantly know how to use and conserve what fortune has dropped in their laps. Once they have their principality, they are quick to lay the foundations that others have had to lay before becoming princes. I'd like to illustrate with two examples from our recent history the two ways, by skill or by fortune, of becoming prince: those of Francesco Sforza and Cesare Borgia. Sforza, through well-chosen means and great skill, began as a private citizen and became the Duke of Milan. What he gained with a thousand toils, he maintained with little effort. On the other hand, Borgia acquired his state through the good fortune of his father, Pope Alexander VI, and through his father's subsequent bad fortune, lost it. This, though Borgia used every means in his power and did all that a prudent and skillful man must do in order to establish himself. When Borgia took over the Romagna, he found it to have been ruled by weak princes who would sooner rob their subjects than govern them, causing dissension rather than unity. Robbery, intrigue, and every kind of evil had been rampant throughout the province, and Borgia found it essential to set up a strong government in order to pacify it and make it submit to his rule. He put in charge a resolute and ruthless man, Ramiro de Lorqua, giving him complete authority. Within the shortest time, de Lorqua had brought peace and unity to the Romagna, gaining much power and influence in the process. But Borgia judged that such excessive authority over the people could have dangerous consequences, as it might arouse their hatred. So he set up a civil court in the center of the province, with an excellent presiding judge, every city having its own advocate. Borgia was aware that de Lorqua's rigor had created hatred among the people, and in order to purge their minds and win them over, he decided to make it clear that if there had been any cruelty, it had been triggered by his minister's abrasive nature. At the first opportunity, he had de Lorqua cut in two on the main square, with a piece of wood and a bloody knife at his side. The brutality of this spectacle left the people both stunned and appeased. Borgia now found himself powerful and to some extent secure, being well armed and having mostly destroyed neighboring armies that might have put him in harm's way. If in the end Borgia did not prevail, it was not his fault, but the result of the extreme malignity of fortune. Pope Alexander died 5 years after Borgia had first drawn his sword, and Borgia himself was now deathly ill. Had he not been ill when Pope Alexander died, he would have had no difficulty. Borgia himself told me on the day Pope Julius II was elected that he, Borgia, had carefully weighed everything that might happen after his father, Pope Alexander, died, and had found a solution for everything. A prince wishing to secure himself against enemies in his new principality can't find a better example than Borgia. He's a compelling example of how to gain friends, how to win by force or deception, how to make the populace love and fear him, and the necessity of eliminating those who can or will harm him. Borgia was exemplary in both his severity and his kindness. He was magnanimous and liberal. He eliminated disloyal troops and marshalled new ones, and cultivated friendships with kings and princes, so that they had to either help him with favours or confront him with caution. There was only one thing he had not anticipated, the possibility that he himself might be at death's door. A prince who obtains a state with the help of the people maintains his position with less difficulty than a prince who acquires it with the help of the nobility. In the latter case, he is surrounded by men who consider themselves his equals and whom he therefore cannot command or govern as he pleases. But a prince who acquires a principality through the favor of the people is unhampered. Only a few in his circle are unready to obey him. A prince cannot shield himself against a populace that is hostile toward him, because there are too many of them, but he can shield himself against the nobles, as they are few in number. And yet he who becomes prince through the favor of the people must keep the people on his side. This should be simple enough, as all they ask of him is that he not oppress them. If he becomes prince through the favor of the nobility against the will of the people, he must make it a priority to win over the people, which is easy enough if he becomes their protector. Because men, when they encounter benevolence where they expected harm, show greater gratitude to their benefactor, and the populace becomes even more supportive than if the prince had acquired the state through their favor. Of those who become princes through evil, I must mention two other ways for a private citizen to become a prince that can't be attributed to fortune or skill. These are when a man obtains a principality in an evil or nefarious way. When Agathocles the Sicilian became king of Syracuse, he did so not only as a private citizen, but as one who came from the lowliest and most humble circumstances. He was the son of a potter, and led a wicked life from first to last. The 3rd century Roman historian Justin writes, "His youth was no more honourable than his birth, for being remarkable for his beauty and physical charm, he lived for a long time by submitting himself to being ravished. Emerging from puberty, he transferred his lust from men to women. Having thus become notorious with both sexes, he changed his way of life to that of a mercenary. And yet he combined his wickedness with such skill of mind and body that when he joined the army, he rose through the ranks to become praetor of Syracuse, the chief judge. Once established in that position, he set about becoming prince and retaining his principality by means of violence. One morning, Agathocles called together the people and the Senate of Syracuse as if to discuss important issues concerning the Republic, and then, at a signal to his soldiers, had them kill all the senators and the richest men of the city. And yet we cannot define as skillful killing one's fellow citizens, betraying one's friends, and showing no loyalty, mercy, or moral obligation. These means can lead to power, but not glory. One might wonder how Agathocles and others like him, after countless betrayals and so much cruelty, could live so long and securely in their states and defend themselves from outside enemies. Why were they never conspired against by their citizens, whereas many others could not retain their states through cruelty? I believe this depends upon whether cruelty is used badly or well. Cruelty can be called well used, if it is even permitted to use the word well in connection with evil, if it is executed at a single stroke out of the necessity to secure one's power. Cruelty is well used if it is then not continued but converted into the greatest possible benefit for one's subjects. Badly used cruelty is cruelty that, even if initially limited, increases with time rather than subsiding. Those who follow the first path can maintain their position in their state with the blessing of God and man, as Agathocles did. The others cannot possibly survive. A prince can conclude from this that when he conquers a state, he must weigh all the acts of cruelty that are necessary and execute them all at a single stroke, so that they won't have to be repeated every day. By not repeating them, he can assure the people and win them over by subsequently benefiting them. Whoever proceeds otherwise through fear or bad judgment must always keep a knife at hand. He can never rely on his subjects, as they cannot feel secure under him. Any cruelty has to be executed at once, so that the less it is tasted, the less it offends. Benefits, on the other hand, must be dispensed little by little, so that they will be savored all the more.
Advisers advise, ministers decide, Margaret Thatcher famously said in a put-down to one out-of-control adviser. The public, though, have always had their doubts, choosing to believe that Sir Humphrey did really control Jim Hacker. Beyond fiction, the same was said to be true of Alistair Campbell and Tony Blair, Dick Morris and Bill Clinton, Karl Rove and George Bush. 5 centuries ago, Niccolo Machiavelli fueled the idea of the adviser as the power behind the throne. The prince was the distillation of the wisdom he gained over many years as a political, military and diplomatic adviser. Naturally, this prince of advisers had a great deal to say about how advisers should be treated. As we shall soon hear, he believed that they should be honoured and made rich. In those days, that advice didn't carry the dangers it does now. At the end of the long list of good advice which Machiavelli sought to dispense was how to deal with fortune, both good and bad. He'd seen more than his fair share of both, having risen high and then sunk low when imprisoned, tortured and banished. His advice was that while fortune and God may be the arbiter of half, perhaps a little more of our actions, the other half is left for free will to prevail. This is one of the few mentions of God in The Prince, a book which shows that Machiavelli believes in the value of human foresight rather than divine providence. This final extract ends with a plea to the man The Prince was written for, Lorenzo de' Medici, who Machiavelli hoped would lead Italy back to greatness. This was not Lorenzo the Magnificent, but his grandson, who far from being magnificent is described by historians as arrogant, inept, an imbecile, and a buffoon. He was not impressed by Machiavelli's gift to the prince, expressing more gratitude for a couple of hounds he was given at the same time. History judges the book of rather more value than The Hounds, although it wasn't until after Machiavelli's death that The Prince was actually published. Its author is buried in the church of Santa Croce in Florence, a few steps from the tombs of Michelangelo and Galileo. The marble monument carries the legend, Tanto nomine nullum par elogium. No elegy is equal to such a name.
Of the advisors of princes. The choice of advisors is very important for a prince. One can assess a prince's intelligence by looking at the men with whom he surrounds himself. If they are capable and loyal, one can consider the prince prudent because he was able to discern their ability and manage to keep them loyal. But when these men are lacking in quality, one can consider the prince as deficient because it is in choosing his advisers that he can make his first mistake. Even if a prince does not possess great intelligence, if he can judge the good or bad that a man says or does, then he can distinguish between his adviser's good and bad deeds, and praise the good and punish the bad. The adviser can't hope to deceive him, and so behaves well. There is a dependable method by which a prince can know his adviser. When the prince sees that the adviser is more intent on furthering his own interest than that of the prince, and that his actions aim to further his own goals, the adviser will never be a good one, and the prince will never be able to trust him. A man who has the prince's affairs of state in hand must never think of himself, but always of the prince. And yet the prince, in order to keep the adviser loyal, must not forget to honour him and make him rich, so that the adviser sees that he cannot exist without the prince. But the prince must also ensure that these many honours do not lead the adviser to desire even more honours, nor that great wealth lead him to desire even greater wealth, nor that his many responsibilities make him fear change. If advisers and princes are of this kind, they can have confidence in one another. If they are not, then things will end badly for one or the other. Of the way in which flatterers must be avoided. There is a danger that a prince can escape only if he is extremely careful or has chosen his advisers well. This danger is the flatterers that fill all princely courts. Men are so self-congratulatory in the things they do, and so willing to deceive themselves, that they find it difficult to escape this plague of flattery, and in attempting to escape it, they often run the risk of losing their standing. The only way for a prince to guard himself from flattering adulation is to make it understood that he will not be offended if he is told the truth. Then again, if every man is free to tell him the truth at will, the prince quickly becomes a figure of contempt. So a prudent prince must approach this in an altogether different way. For his government, he must choose men who are wise and give them, and nobody else, free rein to speak their minds, but only on matters on which he consults them. He must confer with them on every important issue, listen to their opinions, but then reach a decision on his own and in his own way. He must give his counsellors to understand that the more freely they speak, the more he will rely on them. The prince must not listen to anyone other than these counsellors, and he must carry out his decisions unyielding in what he has decided. A prince who acts otherwise will either come to ruin because of his flatterers, or grow increasingly irresolute by following conflicting advice, which will result in his losing respect. There's an example from our own time. Father Luca, the counsellor to the current Emperor Maximilian, has said of His Majesty the Emperor that he never consults anybody, yet still has never managed to do what he wants. This is the result of his behaviour, which is the opposite of what I have just advised. The Emperor is a secretive man, and doesn't inform anyone of his plans, nor does he take advice. But when his plans become clear as he starts putting them into effect, the men surrounding him begin to caution him. As the emperor is easily swayed, he yields, abandoning his plans. The result is that what he does one day, he undoes the next. It is an infallible rule that a prince who is not wise can't be advised well, unless fortune has placed him in the hands of one who is very wise and guides him in every matter. In this case, the prince might fare well, but not for long, because soon enough that counsellor will seize his state from him. My conclusion is that good counsel must be sparked by the wisdom of the prince, and not that the wisdom of the prince be sparked by good counsel. On the extent to which fortune wields power in the affairs of men, and on how this is to be resisted. Many believe that the things of this world are governed to such an extent by fortune and God that men, with all their foresight, cannot change them, that in fact there is no improving them. Those who believe this believe they need not toil and sweat, but can let themselves be governed by fortune. This opinion has been more prevalent in our time because of the great upheavals that we have witnessed and witness every day, and which are beyond anything we could have foreseen, and there have been times when even I have to some extent inclined to this opinion. Nevertheless, fortune seems to be the arbiter of half our actions, but she does leave us the other half, or almost the other half, in order that our free will may prevail. I would compare fortune to one of those violent torrents that flood the plains, destroying trees and buildings, hurling earth from one place to another. Everyone flees this torrent. Everyone yields to its force without being able to stand up to it. As this is the torrent's nature, man should not neglect to prepare himself with dikes and dams in times of calm, so that when the torrent rises, it will gush into a channel, its force neither so harmful nor so unbridled. The same is true with fortune, who unleashes her force in places where man has not taken skillful precautions to resist her, and so channels her force to where she knows there are no dikes or dams to hold her back. Italy, which has been the scene of so many changes, is a field without dikes or dams. Had Italy been protected with the appropriate skill, as Germany, Spain, and France were, this flood either would not have caused the great changes it did, or would not have come at all. The reason for this is the turning of fortune's wheel from good to bad. If a man acts with caution and patience and the wheel turns in a way that favors his course of action, he will flourish. But should the wheel turn again, he will be ruined. It's impossible to find a man prudent enough to be capable of adapting to these changes, because a man can't change his own nature. In my view, however, it is better to be impetuous than cautious, because fortune is a woman. If you wish to dominate her, you must beat and batter her. It's clear that she will let herself be won by men who are impetuous rather than by those who step cautiously. Like a woman, she is more partial to young men, because they are less cautious, wilder, and command her with greater audacity. An exhortation to free Italy from the barbarians. I have given much thought to all the matters I have discussed until now, and have asked myself whether the time is ripe for Italy to greet a new prince, to offer to a prudent and skillful man the prospect of forging a government that would bring him honour and benefit all Italy. So many things have come together that are favourable to a new prince that I believe there has never been a more auspicious time. The people of Israel had to be slaves in Egypt so that the qualities of Moses would come to the fore, in the same way that we may see the prowess of an Italian prince. It has been necessary for Italy to be reduced to the state it is in at present, more enslaved than the Jews, more in bondage than the Persians, more dispersed than the Athenians, without a leader, without order, beaten, plundered, flayed, overrun, exposed to all manner of adversity. How she prays to God to send someone to save her from the barbaric cruelty and violence. How ardent and eager she is to follow a banner, if only there was someone who would raise it high. Italy has one hope, and that hope is your illustrious house, the House of Medici. With its fortune and prowess, a house of which you are now the prince favored by God and church, Saving Italy would not be an insurmountable task if you kept before your eyes the examples of Moses, Cyrus, and Theseus. There is great spirit in the populace, even if it has been lacking in the leaders. Consider our duels and skirmishes, and you will see how the Italian is superior in strength, skill, and ingenuity. You will not find soldiers who are better, more faithful, or more true. Every man among them will be good, and altogether they will become even better once they are commanded by their own prince and are honored and treated well by him. This opportunity must be grasped. Italy, after so many years, must welcome its liberator. The love with which these lands that have suffered a flood of foreign armies will receive him will be boundless, as will be their thirst for vengeance, their iron loyalty, their devotion, and tears. All doors will be flung open. What populace would not embrace such a leader? What envy would oppose him? What Italian withhold respect? For all here abhor the barbarian dominion. Your illustrious house must seize this matter with the kind of spirit and hope in which righteous tasks are seized, so that Italy shall be ennobled beneath its banners and the words of Petrarch will come true. Prowess shall take up arms against brutality, and the battle will be swift, for ancient Roman bravery is not yet dead in Italian hearts.
I will put the nation's interest first. I will put principle before party. I will be open and honest. Thus do those seeking power today seek to persuade those that can confer it upon them that they're worthy of it, that they are, in short, different from most politicians. How Machiavelli would laugh at this. He would know that whatever they may say in public, politicians in this age, as in his own, examine, dissect, and yes, even on occasion celebrate the black arts of the political trade. In private and amongst consenting adults, it is a crime to bury bad news, only when you're caught doing it. It is an error to do favours for your friends, only when they are too blatant. It is wrong to seek to wound your enemy, only when you're seen to do it too gleefully. Governments wouldn't survive long if they were as politically chaste as electorates, and yes, even the media now demand. Call this cynicism, call it realism, call it wickedness. That is the debate that has raged ever since The Prince was written almost five centuries ago. It is first and foremost a pocket how-to guide to the gaining and retaining of power for any prince, any political leader. It is full of insights, both shrewd and amoral, about how to surf the waves of public opinion and how to defeat enemies, whether on the battlefield or in the struggle for popular support. Niccolò Machiavelli wrote his most famous work almost five centuries ago when he was 44 years old. The context, constantly warring Italian states, now seems alien, distant, but the insights themselves can often seem relevant to today. The book embodies the knowledge, he said he'd gained, of the deeds of great men. That knowledge encompassed both the good, he'd had an illustrious career as an ambassador and a politician for Florence, and of course the bad. He'd been wrongly accused of conspiracy, leading to his arrest, torture, imprisonment and exile. It was while in exile that he wrote the work that would bring him both notoriety and longevity. It led Shakespeare to dub him the murderous Machiavelli, and others to give him the satanic nickname Old Nick. Within a generation, the Pope had placed the Prince on the Catholic Church's list of most banned books. And yet, over the centuries that followed, leaders of men treasured their copies. Oliver Cromwell owned a manuscript, Napoleon took his edition to the Battle of Waterloo, and Adolf Hitler claimed to keep a copy on his bedside table. Many of those who spoke ill of the man and his work have never actually read it. Few, too, of those who speak of others as Machiavellian, a description which is rarely meant to be flattering. So, what is it that proves so shocking and yet so enduringly valuable? This first extract of The Prince delivers the brutal advice that men must either be flattered or eliminated. And it offers up some telling advice to those who invade other countries and want to win the support of those whose land they occupy.